So, my talk is at the sort of intersection of these three central debates in philosophy. Is that me? No. That are also three important themes in Hugh's work that we have already talked about. There's the question of whether we should adopt a truth-theoretic semantics on the one hand, or on the other hand, some sort of use-theoretic, semantic deflationary inferentialist view. Crucial issue, as you know, is whether concepts of reference, the derived notion of truth, should be given a central role in explaining meaning and the functioning of language, or whether that's a wrong picture. Reference and truth are merely expressive devices. They can't play any sort of causal role in some kind of empirical semantics, and so we should be doing things, looking at meaning in a different way, in terms of more use theoretic way. I should point out, I mean, this just occurred to me, it's sort of rather ironic fact that, of course, the way the science of linguistics is actually done is truth theoretically. So if the moral of, you know, subject naturalism is respect the science in whatever domain Will is talking about, then one would have to be representationalist.
Well, not all of it.
Maybe it's bad science.
Trotsky is clearly not a representationist.
Not all of them, but, yeah. You know, 90%. That's the mainstream, unfortunately. Anyway, that's one debate. The other debate is over naturalism. Uncontroversially, there is a vast network of naturalistic facts, objects, and properties, including observable phenomena, including the theoretical entities of science that we're led to postulate by virtue of those observable phenomena, and including all the macroscopic things that are built out of those theoretical elements that we've discovered. And an enormous amount is in that naturalistic, causal, explanatory, spatio-temporal network. But is everything in it or not? You know, our meanings, values, possibilities, things like that, are those included? So that's... If you say they are, you're a naturalist. Hugh calls global naturalist, but I'm just going to call that naturalism. If you say no, then you're, you know, a non-naturalist. And the third debate, is it the case that the only route to metaphysical knowledge is on the basis of linguistic data? That is the doctrine of the linguistic turn, very influential, popular in the 20th century philosophy. Maybe it's becoming a little bit less popular now. Anyway, does metaphysics, which on the face of it concerns the world, doesn't the metaphysical doctrines aren't usually explicitly about language or concepts, but about the nature of reality. But is that some kind of illusion, and are they really somehow projections of linguistic data, or not? They seem to be just claims about the outside world. So those are the central themes which are going to come up now. My plan for this talk is to do four things. Firstly, I want to talk about Hugh Price's main anti-naturalist argument, but actually I'm really just focused on one essay of his that's in this volume. I think it's called Naturalism Without Representation. When I say the main argument, I mean the main argument in that paper. Then I'm going to criticize his fundamental assumption, which is in fact the linguistic conception of metaphysics. So he takes a definite view. He takes a view on all of those three issues I initially mentioned, but his view is that one should have a linguistic conception of metaphysics, and that's the main premise of his argument. I'll be I'll be criticizing that. Then I want to, as it were, bolster that criticism by saying, look, we can discuss naturalism and its, you know, pros and cons without going in some way through language. The main arguments can be given without talking about language. And then I want to sort of wrap things up. All right, here's the argument. Firstly, as I've just said, first premise is that we need to have a linguistic conception of metaphysics in general, and the issue of naturalism or non-naturalism in particular. You know, we might, if we're going to arrive at a conclusion that naturalism is correct or naturalism is incorrect, anti-naturalism is correct, so naturalism, there are non-natural phenomena, the data would have to be linguistic in the broad sense that you mentioned he was using it in, that is, including linguistic conceptual. Okay, his second premise is that then, so how are we going to get from the linguistic facts, linguistic data, to some material conclusion? Material-looking conclusion, namely that, you know, everything that exists is naturalistic or something like that. In this paper, he says that we'd need to use some sort of principle of reference. The mediating rule would have to be some disquotational principle like this, that the object X is the referent of the word X. So, with that on the basis of that, that principle can be a bridge, because we can have data concerning, say, the referent of the word such and such, and using that principle we could reach conclusions about the such and such itself. So that would be a bridge, a way of getting from linguistic assumptions to materially metaphysical conclusions, and that would be the way it would have to be done, he says. But then, number three, according to deflationism, this rule wouldn't really be capable of doing that job. Because from the point of view of a deflationary conception of reference, he says, what we mean by the referent of X is exactly the same as what we meant by X in the first place. It's sort of like the referential equivalent of the redundancy theory of truth, or Quine's view of truth, that when you say sentence "Snow is white" is true, that's just another way of saying "Snow is white." And so Hughes says that from a deflationary point of view, you don't really have two levels, or that rule can't mediate two levels, because they say the same thing. You're just sort of, if you started out at language, you still be at the level of language when you deployed that rule, because the rule can't take you from one subject matter to a different subject matter. It's too trivial. Okay. Conclusion, naturalism can't be established. There isn't any way then of getting from linguistic data to a natural material conclusion. You'd have to begin with the linguistic data because of the linguistic conception of metaphysics, so there isn't any way of doing it. And actually, not only can't naturalism be established, but, you know, the falsity of naturalism can't be established either. Non-naturalism, the existence of non-natural things, you know, because that's a metaphysical result, and we simply can't get there from the linguistic data, because the only way of doing it, given the correctness of deflationism, sorry, I skipped over that. Deflationism, the correctness of deflationism is supposed to come out of, I think, come out of subject naturalism, which is just being naturalistic about human activities, including things. You know, sort of a rational scientific scrutiny of the notion of reference will yield deflationism. I'm prepared to concede that premise. Okay, but that's the essence of the, what I think, of the main argument that Hugh gives, and he spends the most time on in that paper. And anyway, I find it interesting, and so I want to comment on that. Actually, I want to, because of lack of time, I want to concentrate on what I think is the most controversial and interesting and insufficiently discussed assumption, which is premise one, and more generally, the merits or demerits of the linguistic conception of metaphysics. Okay, now there are various possible motivations. I think some of them came up in the last paper, but I'm just, for lack of time, going to just focus on the one that Hugh emphasizes. Why does he think that what's the reason for thinking that we need to get to metaphysical conclusions from linguistic premises? Well, he points out that in the discussion of naturalism, it's clear that there are linguistic issues which are absolutely crucial. And he says it's hard to see how these linguistic issues could be crucial, play a crucial role in that, in those debates about naturalism, unless one took this kind of linguistic view of metaphysics as a whole. So let's just, for the sake of an example, focus on normativity. Right? Is normativity a counterexample to naturalism, or isn't it? Okay. Just let's talk about moral norms. There are people who would say, well, if you took moral facts, as it were, or moral claims in the wrong way, you'd think, yeah, God, I can't see how they could be naturalized, so we're going to have a problem. But the way out is to, this is a mistake, some people would say, because going back to the emotivists, a sentence or a pronouncement like stealing is wrong, it's sort of deceptive. The grammatical structure is deceptive. It's not really purporting to express a fact, or doesn't really express a proposition or a possible belief in the first place. Okay, it's not in the fact-stating business. And this kind of linguistic examination of areas of discourse, in this case moral discourse, can yield that conclusion, and that will obviously have some bearing, considerable bearing, on the prospects for naturalism. Those will be important things to do. Fine. But, on the other hand, as I say there are some problems with that motivation for adopting the linguistic conception of this particular issue and of metaphysics more generally. Firstly, it just really seems to be a preliminary. It doesn't get you the whole way there. If you do this investigation, you're persuaded by emotivism for linguistic, reasons, and so you think, okay, not in the facts of the business, then you'll think, okay, don't have to worry about that then, when I'm trying to decide whether to be a naturalist. One less placement problem to worry about. The job will be somewhat simplified, but still, it's not like the end of the story. What about the thing, what if you don't reach that conclusion about wrong, and you decide, no, and the linguistic investigation tells you, no, actually, I do think that they are ordinary propositions that can be believed and not believed, as we intuitively think, and they can be true or false, and so, so what are we going to do? There's still then work to be done to decide whether we have a potential problem for a naturalist. So if we have reached that conclusion that we're dealing, I suppose we do reach that conclusion, it's a genuine proposition and can be believed and so on. Do we have some potential problem for naturalism? Well, we can say what we've decided in thinking that we've a genuine proposition there is that if stealing is wrong, then there is a fact that stealing is wrong, and so the issue will be, is it naturalistic or not? So we'll only have a problem if stealing is wrong. Only then will be this fact that may or may not be a counterexample to naturalism. So we're going to have to first of all find out whether stealing is wrong to assess naturalism. We don't have any reason for thinking that that issue is going to be settled by some kind of, you know, linguistic investigation. So this is just pushing the point that just because there are granted certain linguistic preliminaries to this investigation that occur at the beginning, of course, it's hard to think of any investigation where there might not well be linguistic preliminaries of clarifying what the issues are and so on. But anyway, certainly it is important here. Generally, it's important in any domain, physics or anywhere else. But not surprisingly, having got the preliminaries out of the way, there's more work that needs to be done, and there's no reason to think that further work to help us decide the question is to be conducted by, first of all, looking at language. Okay, so whether stealing is wrong, for instance. Now, secondly, suppose we've decided, okay, stealing is wrong. There is a fact, is it naturalistic or not? Now, is that question of whether it's naturalistic to be settled by looking at language? Well, you know, you might think, well, we could sort of approach it through language. You could say, well, you know, see whether a... You might say, well, look, whether a sentence is naturalistic. Depends on whether it somehow has some kind of causal explanatory input. You know, we might notice that, so we might say, look, stealing is wrong. Wrong. So looking, let's focus on whether wrong is naturalistic. We might say, does wrong enter into sentences that we accept that are causal explanatory in nature, in character? Wrongness causes this, or wrongness is, you know, caused by that. I mean, there are other such things that we accept. So that's a way of looking at the thing through language, and we might say, yes, we have such sentences, so wrongness is a naturalistic term, or no, you know, we can't find there are no such sentences, so wrongness isn't a naturalistic term. But it seems sort of a bit arbitrary and maybe even somewhat perverse to think, well, we have to look at it through language. After all, the sentences that, whenever we accept a certain sentence, we are committing ourselves to a certain fact. I mean, accepting a sentence is the same thing as committing ourselves to a certain fact. So instead of thinking, well, what we should be doing is looking at the language, you know, and the sentences containing the word wrong, why not just think about what facts we believe in concerning wrong, right and wrong? You know, and seeing whether those facts, whether there are facts involving wrongness that are causal explanatory in nature. And in fact, that really seems like the more natural way of thinking about it. It's presumably in virtue of, you know, our beliefs about the external world, the facts about the external world to which we are commit ourselves. That's explanatory first. Only then do we reflect and think, oh, we do how we have those beliefs. So our awareness of the beliefs that we have is explanatory later than the beliefs themselves. And that awareness of what beliefs we have can be recapitulated in terms of an awareness of what sentences we accept. But the first thing there is, what beliefs do we have about right and wrong? And we look at those to see whether we think that wrongness is causal explanatory or naturalistic phenomenon. Anyway, so my bottom line on this is that we don't really get any motivation for this linguistic conception of metaphysics. And the one offered that Hugh offers, I think, that he puts most weight on, isn't going to get us to that conclusion. Now I want to try and bolster this with what I think would be the right way to argue against naturalism. So I'm also against naturalism, but I get it in a different way, one that does not assume a kind of linguistic priority, but just looks at the whole business primarily, but not wholly, at the material level. I don't think there's an embarrassment in the fact that it's not wholly at the material level, because as I've said, it's hard to think of any investigation of any matter that proceeds only by giving an argument at the material level for some conclusion. You know, you always, or pretty much always, especially if you're responsible, should do preliminary semantic reflection and clarification. You always should do reflection on your argument, as critical reflection, to see whether the norms of reason are satisfied. You always should do an assessment of arguments for alternative conclusions to see whether they're rational. So there's always a direct, your own argument, which is at the material level, from beliefs about the external world to beliefs about the external world, but then there's all sorts of other reflective things that go on in supporting that case. All right, anyway, so here's the sketch of the argument, then I'll go into more detail. I begin by noting that it seems to me the primary case for naturalism is a kind of a sort of induction. It's the idea that, you know, surely the world must be somehow fundamentally uniform. We're so impressed with the huge range of different kinds of facts from all over that are naturalizable, though one thinks, from looking for a simple theory, which the metaphysician wants, that just on grounds of theoretical simplicity, you know, it's probable that everything is naturalistic. You know, and the apparent counterexamples can be dealt with in one way or the other. So I think that's the central reason that people are tempted by naturalism. Such a hell of a lot of stuff is naturalistic, and surely the other things can be fit in one way or the other, the non-obvious things. And my central criticism of this is going to be that it deploys a norm which is very familiar in science and perfectly respectable and has earned its keep in science, that of preference for simple theories, or views that simple theories are likely to be true, and so on. But I think that really what's going on here is that in fact, that norm is not really being deployed, but some distorted and illegitimate version of it. Okay, first of all, though, the direct reason for not being a naturalist, before you come to criticize the argument for naturalism, is, I think, simply this, that it's just prima facie extremely plausible that amongst the many sorts of facts that we recognize, some are non-natural, that is, don't play any causal explanatory role, and don't talk about stuff located in space and time, which are the main criteria. So on the face of it, if you weren't, as it were, in the grip of a theory already, not a physical theory, you look at such things as, you know, facts that there are numbers, that it's good to care about the welfare of other people, that if dogs bark, then dogs bark, that the world could have been a different from the way it is, and you think, well, those don't seem like naturalistic facts. And of course, they are the kinds of things that the naturalists do find problematic, have to be handled somehow. Tamed. But on the face of it, they're not naturalistic. So taking just the intuitive data at face value, we have reasons not to be naturalists from the get-go. Okay. So the issue is why we should be sort of talked out of that, really. In itself, it's intuitively plausible. What's the resistance by the naturalist to these sorts of examples? Well, as you know, what you get for any subject, different types of resistance in different cases by different philosophers who are naturalistic sympathizers, sometimes the reaction is to give some sort of rather surprising radical analysis of the facts in question, which show that reveal them to be actually naturalistic after all. So a naturalistic analysis is presupposed. And the other main thing is to say, well, actually, there are no such things. Okay. There's no such thing we don't have to worry about. So you can be a kind of skeptic about the... You can either be a sort of radical reductionist or a skeptic. Those are the two main ways of dealing with these kinds of cases. So, for example, in the case of... that came up earlier, of Platonism, or mathematical objects, numbers, you know, they seem to be problems. So a radical reduction could be to try to reduce numbers to numerals, marks on a piece of paper, so something naturalistic. Or you could be a skeptic, like Hartree Fields. And sometimes skepticism is made more palatable by advocating a kind of fictional sense. But the bottom line is, you don't think there are any. Or in the moral domain, there are these constructivist reductions of facts about what is right and wrong to facts about what people believe is right and wrong. Naturalistic facts, in that case. This is all done, you know, there's an agenda. It's not just a kind of a dispassionate attempt to understand these concepts. It's an attempt to understand the concepts in such a way that they won't threaten naturalism. Or there's the skeptical views of people like Mackey as a way of preserving naturalism. These people, Mackey obviously was a naturalist. And the point is that these ways out are clearly ad hoc and contrived, and in themselves implausible, taken on their own. You know, oh, how about this for you? You'd say, well, no, that's crazy. To say there aren't any numbers, what do you mean? Any numbers? There's a prime number between, 5 and 9. So, deny that there are moral facts, how does that differ from denying that torture is wrong? So these are implausible things. But the naturalist has a comeback and says, well, look, true, these things are taken on their own, contrived and undesirable. But there's a greater benefit. This is a price worth paying for the great increase in global simplicity we're going to get from this wonderfully simple metaphysics, naturalism. So this is where the norm supposedly coming from science is deployed. We've got to think of the global simplicity and in metaphysics, and that's what we're going to get. And so it's worth putting up with these sort of local implausibilities, where local contrivances and local losses of simplicity for the overall gain. All right, what's wrong with that? Well, first of all, it seems to me that what you have to give up for the sake of naturalism is you're not just really sacrificing a little bit of simplicity in sort of local domains. You're actually being asked to give up data, or what counts as data in philosophy, namely basic convictions, sometimes called intuitions, but we can take that spooky notion out of it, just basic, epistemologically basic convictions, things that are absolutely convinced and we can't think how to get underneath them and defend them. They're sort of fundamental for us. That's what's being given up often in these cases. And so that's one thing. So for instance, as Frege made a big deal of this, we're pretty sure that Julius Caesar wasn't a number. I'm joking, we're convinced, we know that Julius Caesar wasn't a number. And that's not, this is like data. And so any philosophical theory or metaphysical theory that says, well, look, it's so simple, and all you'd have to do is agree that Julius Caesar was a number, and you know, you could have that theory, we'd say, well, you know, this isn't just, you know, this is giving up, you know, a date, which is a serious thing. And moreover, and this is, I think, my central point, the norm of simplicity that we do deploy in science is not deployed in that way. It's not a license to ignore inconvenient facts. You can't, in science, say, look, you know, I've got this empirical generalization. It works most of the time. All ravens are black, kind of. And then somebody sees a white one and you say, no, right, never mind. It doesn't fit the simple theory. So I'm going to insist that all ravens are black. That's not legitimate application of the norm of theoretical simplicity. What happens in science is that if you've got some generalization you rather like at some level, say at the superficial, phenomenological, experiential level, observational level, and it doesn't really work, then you go down a level, you go to some underlying level, you look for a simple law at a more basic, microscopic level, and what you're supposed to be able to do is, from the perspective of that underlying level, given the simple law that you found and various, you know, circumstantial factors operative at that underlying level, which can be pretty messy, you then are supposed to explain all the data, not just the ones that, you know, not just the black ravens, but all of them. Everything is supposed to be explained. You're not allowed to throw any of the facts away. But the crucial thing is that the move to simplicity isn't just done by deeming that the things that don't fit a simple theory, you know, must be false. It's done by, in fact, accepting that can't be correct, or by going down a level and looking for the simplicity there. But clearly that is not done by the naturalist in this case. No move like that is made. Such explanations of the data that you're being asked to give up, you know, are not offered, and it's hard even to imagine how they could be offered, because, as it were, a priori reality doesn't have the same structure, complex structure, as physical reality or material reality. You don't have these different metaphysical layers. You don't have pretty random circumstantial factors that might be combined with simplicity at one level to produce, you know, messiness at the next level. So it's not really surprising that strategy is not engaged in here, because it's hard to imagine how it could be. Anyway, so my conclusion is then that it's just not true that naturalism is mandated by the very norm or norms that have earned it respect from their fruitful role in science. That is the norm of simplicity. In fact, it seems to me if those norms, if we aren't prepared to flout them, will lead an honest thinker to recognize a variety of non-natural phenomena. So that is supposed to be a material case against naturalism, and I sort of final moral, repeating some things I've already said, but these considerations, the anti-naturalistic considerations that I've been deploying, they do involve some preliminary clarifications. They involve an argument for the material conclusion that there are non-natural facts that doesn't operate anywhere at the linguistic level. And then there's criticism of alternative lines of thought leading to alternative conclusions. In this case, the criticism of the argument, which was also at the material level, for naturalism. And so I'd say that this suggests or bolsters the idea that reasoning in metaphysics and philosophy more generally is primarily from beliefs about the non-linguistic world to beliefs about the non-linguistic world. Now, it may well be that the linguistic and methodological self-consciousness and self-scrutiny that we're going for does play a greater role in our field than in other areas of inquiry, but that's merely because confusion is obviously more rampant in philosophy than it is elsewhere. Okay, but that doesn't detract from the fact that centrally we are making claims that go beyond claims about language, and we conduct arguments at the non-linguistic level for those conclusions. Alongside those arguments, we do this more reflective stuff, as in every other domain of inquiry. Thank you.